PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There are precise mathematical relationships between harmonious notes.
The whole thing blends itself into a big blanket of richness.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we find out how Arnold Schoenberg revolutionized the sound of the 20th century.
There are songs in there that are like Gershwin if he was stoned or something.
And when bad colors turn out to be good.
Early 90s, I saw a lot of people wearing chartreuse and pink. Just because, hey, never saw this before, I'm making a statement.
My guest is the composer and jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. During the 1980s, the word postmodern was so overused by writers to mean any stylish work of art or culture that had a kind of winking self-consciousness, that we all got sick of it and stopped using it. But even though the word went away, the postmodern sensibility, hip, jokey self-consciousness, has remained ubiquitous in art and music and film. Just look at the names of things. A few years ago, Dave Eggers published his funny, sad, novelish memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. The book really was heartbreaking and brilliant, but Eggers was having fun. He turned an over-the-top promotional blurb into a title that was packed with a kind of self-mocking, half-serious pseudo-boastfulness. Now, the author Jinsey Willette is about to out Eggers. Her forthcoming sad, funny, and memoirish novel is called The Winner of the National Book Award. Postmodern movie titles take the opposite tack. They are willfully generic.
Hello.
As
Wanna
in Scary
fun.
Movie, the Who's spoof this? Of horror films.
Do you like scary movies?
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite?
I don't know.
Think.
Oh, I know. Kazam, you know the one where Shaq plays a genie?
That's not a horror movie.
Well, you haven't seen Shaq act.
Or Spike Jonze's fictionalized adaptation of the nonfiction book The Orchid Thief, which was called simply Adaptation.
So tell me your thoughts on this crazy little project of ours.
First, I think it's a great book. I just don't want to ruin it by making it a Hollywood thing, you know, like an orchid heist movie or changing the orchids into poppies and turning into a movie about drug running, you know?
In pop music, postmodern naming takes the form of homage. Or maybe they're pseudo-homages. It's hard to tell. In the 1970s, an English singer named Declan McManus invented a stage name consisting of his mother's maiden name and the given name of an American pop music icon. Thus, Elvis Costello. And in the 1990s, a guy in Ohio named Brian Warner decided one good way to appeal to teenagers who want to freak out their parents would be to adopt the first name of a female pop icon and the surname of the most famous mass murderer of the age. Voila, Marilyn Manson. Right now, I've noticed, a new kind of jokey, media-obsessed band-naming protocol is on the rise. It's the appropriation by alternative bands of not-all-that-celebrated celebrities' names. Like the British band The Real Tuesday Weld, named after the 59-year-old actress whose career peaked back in the 1960s.
It's raining, it's pouring, but I ain't complaining.
And the Gina Rowlands Band, named after the 68-year-old blonde actress whose best-known roles were in the 1970s. The Gina Rowlands Band, incidentally, pursues this particular obsession all the way. Among their recordings are the song Garofalo C'est Moi, an ode to the comedian Janine Garofalo.
I finally found what love is only in the movie.
And believe it or not, there's yet another band named after a different semi-well-known Gina. The Brooklyn band Gina Colada took its name from the byline of the New York Times science reporter Gina Colada. According to the band's drummer, We like the sound of it, its rhythm. In other words, the choice was not quite random, but almost, which is meant to signify a kind of arch intelligence, which is, moreover, the point of all these titles and names. Here's how it works. For starters, it's a little naughty to take a living stranger's name for the name of your band, and naughty is alternative. And if you take an arcane celebrity's name, it flatters your fans. They have to be with it enough to get the reference. That's even more alternative. Finally, these kinds of band names also have a certain slackery fatalism built in. Choosing a goofy novelty name like the Gina Rowlands Band means the group is practically embracing the fact out front that it probably won't make it big and doesn't really care. Which I actually think is kind of cool, in a postmodern way. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story on Harmony. This is the voice of a traditional throat singer from the Asian country of Tuva. He's able to make three notes at once, two in his throat and one by forcing air through spaces that we all have somewhere in our heads. Tuva is famously the only country on the planet that keeps an index of national happiness. So the chords in that earthy, full voice spring from a culture that really values harmony in the widest sense. We're talking today about harmony in music, and also as an idea, a larger idea. Harmony describes how all kinds of things work next to each other, the reverberations between them. It's the difference between two or three notes or a few buildings in a skyline or two figures in a painting that creates a mood that's dissonant or bright or startling or calm, all of which harmony can be. My guest today is the composer and jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. Hirsch has made a name for himself by digging into the standard repertoire and reinventing it. He's pulled new things from the music of Billy Strayhorn and Thelonious Monk. Fred Hirsch, welcome to Studio 360.
Very nice to be here.
How did you become a jazz pianist?
Well, it's not generally the sort of thing that one, I guess, consciously decides. I started playing piano as a 4-year-old. It was in the house, and grandparents were reasonably musical. My parents are not particularly talented. Sorry, Mom, Dad. But they went to symphony concerts and, you know, made that kind of music available to me. And I really just sort of went to it. It wasn't, nobody forced me or asked me. And from the very beginning, I would improvise. But typically, my improvisations would sound like classical music because that's sort of what I came from. And I also went, when I was in, from around 3rd to 6th grade, I think the best thing that my parents did for me in terms of my musical development was they gave me private instruction in kind of musical building blocks. For instance, by the time I was out of elementary school, I had done what most freshmen and sophomores do at a conservatory.
Kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, it was kind of, I guess, the prodigy thing. And then when I got out of high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, so I went to college in Iowa, at Grinnell College, and I kind of stumbled into a jazz club on a cold winter night and was fascinated. As much by the people and sort of the weirdness and kind of wackiness of the whole scene. It was very non-conservatory, non-white. And I asked to sit in, and they indulged me, and I made lots of mistakes.
How brave of you.
Well, I mean, it was Tuesday night, and, you know, six people in the audience and four on the bandstand. I figured I got nothing to lose. So I'd sat in, and the only song that I really kind of knew was the tune Autumn Leaves. And I made lots of errors, you know, in terms of the form. And, you know, I had no experience. And this great older saxophone player who was leading the group, he took me in the back room and he sat me down and made me listen to Paul Gonzalez's solo on the blues on Duke Ellington Live at Newport, 1956.
Which he happened to have?
Which he happened to have on a record player in the back room. And he said, look, you seem to have a lot of talent. You seem like a nice kid. Why don't you get some records, listen, and come back? So I went to the record store and I bought every record that had Autumn Leaves on it because I didn't know any better. And I realized from that point that, first of all, they were all great in their own way. There was no best recording, and that they were all personal. And for some reason, I realized, too, that I really had the right kind of what we would now call a skill set to be a jazz musician in terms of loving to do things with people, in front of people, not being a grind away in my room kind of musician, liking to take chances, liking the social aspect of the whole thing. And basically I dropped out of school and started learning how to play. You know, that's where it kind of started. So there was no conscious decision, but once it bit me pretty hard.
When you were really developing your craft, what harmonies excited you?
My grandfather's a violinist, and I used to listen to string quartet recordings. And a very famous string quartet lived in our neighborhood, the LaSalle Quartet. And my piano teacher was the wife of the cellist. So I used to go listen to them rehearse, or I would be around their concerts. They would give house concerts. And I was always fascinated. I would try to follow the viola through against the violin, or the cello against the, you know, and just see how these beautiful horizontal parts made all this great vertical harmony. And so I kind of try to do that as much as I can on the piano.
When you say the horizontal parts that result in vertical harmony, you're speaking as if each instrument can be described by a wave, and it's the overlapping of those two waves.
It's the confluence, the vertical kind of confluence of those waves that gives us chords.
And thus harmony.
Right. When you have four notes, you know, in classic Western harmony, the Bach chorales or something like that, you basically have four parts, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and they all want to move. They don't just sit there. So I've always been interested in, you know, when I play the piano and trying to have the independence and to let my ear work in such a way that things can really, there's lots going on underneath it. It's not just vertical chunks of notes. It's all those notes, every note in that chord, each one may or may not want to move somewhere, you know.
Well, so, instead of just talking about it, let's move over to that beautiful piano there and you can demonstrate.
Okay. When you have just two notes going on at the same time, it may outline a harmonic movement, but basically, when you have any two notes, you know, playing at the same time, theoretically they work with each other. There are no mistakes. The more notes you get, the more tricky it becomes. I was thinking of a folk song that I used to play as a kid, Black is the Color. So one thing that I could do here, I'll try to play the tune through with very, very simple harmony once, and then I'll play through again with perhaps more complex harmony.
Great.
See what you all think. Thank you.
So that's a fairly diatonic melody. There's no sharps or flats. So, I mean, if I sat and probably messed with it, I could probably come up with many, many, many different ways of harmonizing that particular melody. Some would be pretty whacked out, and some would be more like that kind of functional harmony.
When people, when amateurs, when non-singers get together and sing, they can usually carry the tune, carry the melody. But when they try to actually harmonize, that's a much more difficult thing to do. Why is that? What is it about harmony that makes it less simple or primal than carrying a melody?
Well, it's the old cliche, if you look at human nature, why can't we all just get along, you know? It's a similar sort of thing, you know? When you're particularly singing in a four-part group, when you're singing the alto or the tenor, the inner voices, you have to adjust your pitch relative to what's above and below you and hold your own. You know, there's all kinds of life metaphors if you want to get into that.
Well, there are, and which is interesting because in artistic realms, and music not least, there are all kinds of complicated forms of harmony that are not just, you know, Norman Rockwellian sweetness.
Exactly. And also, you need contrast, you know, to really appreciate the resolution of a beautiful major chord. You need something going before it that builds tension. And all of Western music and a great deal of Western visual art and Western theater is all about, you know, conflict resolution, whether it's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, whether it's, you know, what happens, you know, in the paintings of, you know, of Picasso or, you know, I mean, it's all kind of the same thing. And then, so you appreciate the consonants. But if it's all vanilla, then it's vanilla. You know, you got to have, it's got to come from somewhere.
The jazz pianist Fred Hirsch is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're talking about harmony. In a minute, we'll listen to Arnold Schoenberg's Musical Revolution. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is supported in part by Nonesuch Records, featuring Buenos Hermanos, the new solo album by Buena Vista Social Club vocalist Ibrahim Ferrer, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest is the jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. We're talking about harmony. If harmony is about rules, then the first half of the 20th century was all about breaking them, when classical music went through its gigantic harmonic shift. And as Sarah Fischko explains, Arnold Schoenberg was at the heart of that shift.
One of the joys of listening to classical music is hearing history move along, from this to this to this to this. Noting how Beethoven added new intervals to the acceptable musical vocabulary, noting how French has its own harmonic sound, and how distinctively Russian something can be. And so on through the ages, oh so gradually. Even when the changes are gradual, audiences of the time gasp to hear a new chord, a new harmonic advance, and then they embrace it. Arnold Schoenberg's harmonic revelations could not be considered particularly gradual, having gone from this to this in just a few years. Schoenberg broke every harmonic rule and created new ones of his own. And he also broke the unspoken rule that said these changes have to happen over generations so audiences can absorb them. Audiences could not. And as composers of the succeeding generation fell under his spell, some never forgave him for having, as they said, destroyed music.
Well, isn't it amazing that such an interesting personality somehow isn't a part of people's general consciousness the way other fascinating figures from his time are?
Alan Shaun's book, Arnold Schoenberg's Journey, is a new look at the man responsible for what was seen as a harmonic assault. There's a photo of the composer on the cover, and he's looking very human, gazing quizzically into the camera.
I fought very hard to have it be the really terrific picture of him holding his hat in his hands and standing on a ship where, you know, he really looks like he's on a kind of magical and strange voyage that surprises even him.
Schoenberg's strange voyage took him from the 19th century into the 20th, from Vienna to Hollywood, and from an explosion of success to almost total alienation from the music community. And now, back again, perhaps, he emerges from Shaun's book as a complicated, sympathetic man possessed by genius, compelled to bring music into what was then the future, having begun in the most logical way, as a composer immersed in classical tradition.
He was steeped in the three B's, basically, and one M, Mozart. He adored Mozart.
He had taken the music world by storm with Verklärte Nacht, Transfigured Night, and Gurlieder, a gigantic two-hour song cycle.
When Arnold Schoenberg was young, he had a tremendous success and notoriety, which won him great praise from Strauss and various other important musicians of the day.
Fred Sherry has just recorded the Schoenberg Mon Cello Concerto.
However, as soon as he diverged from the path of the great classical music around Opus 11, everybody gave up on him, and he became a submerged figure that never came up in the public's mind again.
And yet he, as they say, went there.
Once he opened the door to the new kind of harmony that he heard, he really couldn't ever turn back from that. And I believe that the aspect of newness in Schoenberg's music is everywhere.
It was a step being taken in the arts in general in this period as World War I was on the horizon. It was unique in history.
To go from painting in which you can recognize right off the bat what the objects were that were in front of the painter to paintings in which you're looking at forms and compositions without any clear reference, that's an unbelievable step.
And the parallel in music is starting out knowing you're in one key or another.
To go from that to music in which you are not in a key at any point and you do not resolve into a key at the end, that is simply an astonishing thing.
Even our hero, Arnold Schoenberg, and his circle were astonished.
Webern uses the word panic about that moment in their work when they realized that it no longer actually was true to the piece to pretend that it had been tonal. To simply display a tonal coat of arms, to use Schoenberg's phrase, at the end of a piece when it hasn't been tonal at any other point, it felt dishonest and ridiculous.
So he went all the way.
You might say he relaxed. He faced the implications of the language that, in fact, he was using. Those sounds were valued in a new way for their own sake. And in the Book of the Hanging Gardens, I think Schoenberg found that there was an incredible beauty and magic to letting that language of tones be what it really wanted to be. There are songs in there that are like Gershwin if he was, you know, maybe stoned or something. They're so beautiful, they just don't happen to resolve. You want to sing along, and every single song is just so fantastic.
Singing along with Schoenberg may be the province of a special few, He didn't make it easy. But knowing more about the man helps, and Sean's book reveals maybe a kinder, gentler Schoenberg.
Well, I mean, gentle is not exactly the word we would use, is it? But kind, definitely. I mean, he tried tremendously hard to help colleagues and friends who were trapped in Nazi Germany when he himself had gotten out. He himself was impoverished, but he taught Berg for free because he believed in Berg's talent.
Even when he was borrowing rent money from Gustav Mahler.
I once talked to Larry Schoenberg about his father, and Larry mentioned that he was a very sweet man at home, and he would pack lunches for them to go to school with, and he would make the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the shape of eighth notes and other musical forms.
What a guy. The interesting thing is that Schoenberg was compelled to break the rules, but he craved acceptance as much as any artist. The letter of his I keep coming back to is the one written on the 12th of May, 1947, from California to Hans Rosbaud. "There's nothing I long for more intensely," Schoenberg writes, "than to be taken for a better sort of Tchaikovsky, or if anything more, than that people should know my tunes and whistle them." I don't know if I'm ready to whistle his tunes, but 51 years after his death, the world seems readier than it's ever been to make his wish come true. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
If you'd like to find out anything more about Arnold Schoenberg, check out our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, and my guest today is the jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. Our subject is harmony. Fred, what do you think of Schoenberg? I know you've thought a lot about him.
You know, I can't claim that he would be on my top 10 list of people to just sort of put on just for sitting around. Certainly as somebody who's been exposed to his music since I was a young person, I find the rhythmic energy, the color of it, the way it's constructed very, very interesting. And some of it incredibly beautiful. He also wrote a lot of great piano music. And, you know, he always gets lumped with Berg and Webern and as the new Viennese school. I mean, it makes sense. And they all had different temperaments and characters and influences and musicians that follow them in different ways. I don't really believe, though, that you can mandate how people hear.
Which they tried to do.
Which he particularly tried to do. And, you know, there's a reason that Western harmony still has resonance to us. Because it works. You know, it goes back to Greeks and overtone series and how intervals affect us and all kinds of things like that.
Do you think it goes deeper than that? I mean, are there physical processes, the way we process musical data in the brain, that makes us seek harmony?
Maybe. To those who can speak the language of music. I mean, to a lot of people, you know, they wouldn't understand the distinction between, you know, a good bottle of wine and an incredibly great bottle of wine. I'm not saying it'd be wasted on them. I'm sure they'd appreciate it, but they couldn't describe the distinction. And a lot of people view, you know, quote, 12-tone music or that as kind of noise or random or egg-headed.
Well, it's certainly what has convinced a lot of people over the last 50 or 75 years that 20th century orchestral music is not something they're interested in.
Well, unfortunately, when any art form becomes so self-referential and so insular, when it becomes, you know, people writing pieces of music that are not really, they're not really what I call ear music, that doesn't mean that it can't be good art, but it loses its sort of relevance. And I'm not saying that that means it has to be Andrew Lloyd Webber either. There is something in the middle. where these techniques and the march of history and the evolution of music can be integrated, but in a way that still relates to humanity.
Are there harmonies that by their nature upset us, sort of hit a sore nerve somehow in the brain?
I don't know. I mean, think of the score to Psycho.
Bernard Herrmann.
Exactly. You know, I mean, the way that those screaming violins with that unbelievable rhythm were used to create suspense. I mean, music does do things that are primal to us. You know, intervals and sounds, you know, different instruments and different registers and different kinds of chords and intensity. They generally do resonate with people.
The jazz pianist composer Fred Hirsch is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are talking about harmony. As we've said, the word harmony applies to more than music. It's a metaphor that we lay on to all kinds of art. And the rules of how colors go together, for instance, have been written about exhaustively. From KCRW in Los Angeles, Matt Holtzman wanted to find out exactly what those color rules mean.
For my bar mitzvah in the 1970s, I wore a dark burgundy three-piece suit, a red and turquoise shirt, and a tan tie. Pictures of me in that outfit are a humbling reminder of how our sense of color harmony changes over the years. I asked Richard Keyes, an artist and graphic designer who teaches at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, if there are any rules about color harmony that actually stand the test of time.
What are organically pleasing color combinations?
Well, I can easily begin with analogous colors are usually pleasing because they all relate to each other very easily.
What is analogous colors?
Colors that are close to each other on a color wheel, so a red-orange, and a red-violet, would all have a core of redness. And most things that we consider harmonious, even in music or food, are based on some kind of general principle, a guiding principle makes them harmonious.
Keyes took me to the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena to see colors actually in the process of harmonizing. The first painting he shows me is by Joseph Albers, who wrote the definitive color textbook in 1963 called Interaction of Color. It's still required reading in art schools today.
This is Albers' Homage to the Square Red Series, Untitled No. 3, 1968.
Untitled No. 3 is a great example of how analogous colors work together to create a sense of harmony.
It is like all of his Homage to the Square series, three squares within each other. This happens to have a saturated, brilliant red-orange in the center, surrounded by a somewhat duller red-orange, leaning more towards red around it, and then that is surrounded by crimson. So it's going from very warm in the center to generally cooler on the outside and almost feels like the glow of a fire.
Now one can expect that almost anybody looking at this would find it to be
pleasing and harmonious. I think so, because all the colors chosen and all the shapes chosen are resonant with all the other colors and shapes.
Complementary colors aren't as serene as analogous colors, but opposites like red and green and blue and orange can be pleasing too. They tend to be pretty strong next to each other, so they only work in the right proportion.
We're more comfortable seeing little bits of light against dark. If we saw an equal amount of yellow and blue, it would just seem vulgar.
But some of the most amazing color combinations of all are a kind of hybrid of analogous and complementary colors. They're called split complementaries.
Split complementaries mean colors that are opposite except you're using three of them. So one color is standard and two colors are near each other, but they're not the exact opposite of the other color. Those two colors tend to group and share qualities, but they expand the range of that quality. The most popular of those colors is yellow-orange against blue-violet and blue-green. Now, that is a beautiful combination. It is the combination of a Caribbean beach. Exactly.
If you don't have nature's eye, you can still make colors work together by tossing in something that works with everything. There's a musical equivalent to this idea.
In some world music, let's say a tambora in Indian music is a drone that is basically one note that goes through an entire composition that all the other notes chosen are meant to work with, enhance, and resonate with.
But then again, harmony's not the same thing in music as it is with color. Margaret Livingstone is a neurobiologist at Harvard and the author of Vision and Art, The Biology of Seeing.
Harmony is a term from music in which there are very precise mathematical relationships between harmonious notes. I think when you come to color, there is no physical basis for such harmony.
A chord is a predictable thing with three notes resonating with each other. But color harmony isn't just about how colors resonate with each other. It's how we resonate with them. And Dr. Livingstone says how we feel about colors isn't hardwired.
Pleasure is when you learn to associate the color of a fruit with eating. And so I would contend that most of your color associations are learned or cultural, because I don't think they have any basis in the biology.
If you violate these associations, you get a pretty unpleasant effect.
We're looking at Vincent van Gogh's Portrait of the Artist's Mother, 1888, and it's green, including the skin. It is beyond jaundice. It's almost as if her face was made of copper and has been standing out in the sun too long. The color combination as principles or abstractions of sensations could certainly be pleasant. But we expect to see flesh when we look at a face. And since this violates that expectation so dramatically, it's unpleasant. It makes us a little bit nervous.
This is a good example of how far our relationship to color has come in the last 100 years. We might not like a painting with a green face, but it doesn't offend us the way it offended the public in Van Gogh's day.
We have grown up in a dramatically visual world. We see color on TV, on the sides of buses, magazines. So we will accept most anything. A good example is chartreuse and pink. Chartreuse is a light yellow-green. And these were sort of classic bad colors. These were colors that our teachers talk about as they never use these together. They clash. Early to mid-90s, I saw a lot of people wearing chartreuse and pink. It was very popular. And just because it's, hey, you never saw this before, I'm making a statement with these colors. And then it became accepted. And then people who would have hated them 5 years ago began to like them now.
It's the job of color forecasters like the Color Marketing Group and the Color Association of the U.S. to watch for trends like this and predict what's next. But they have a pretty tough job. Even Joseph Albers, the master of color himself, knew it was all about personal taste. As gentlemen prefer blondes, he wrote, so everyone has preference for certain colors and prejudice against others. For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman.
I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is the pianist and composer Fred Hirsch. We're talking about harmony. Fred, you're pretty sensitive to color, aren't you?
Sure. I mean, there are some really unlikely colors that are very, very harmonious together. Something that I learned from a woman that helped me. I've lived in the same loft for 24 years, and it's had different incarnations. At one point, it was a big white room, and then it was a recording studio, and then it was sort of a nondescript. I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. Anyway, I had to do some renovation a few years ago, and I got somebody who was a color consultant. I didn't want an interior decorator. I just knew that I could do more with color. And I told her what I wanted. I said I wanted a deep green room with a purple ceiling for my bedroom. And I said, the rest of the place, whatever you want to do. And she, at first, this was not particularly her palette, but this was a very astute woman.
I don't think it's anyone's palette, Fred.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, most of us, we pick a color. We pick a color chip, and then we pick another color chip. But this was a woman who understood that if you're standing in one room, you see other rooms. And it's not just each color that it needs to be beautiful, but it needs to interact with all the other colors, which may be very unlikely colors. And so I have 6 different colors in my loft. And some of them are not colors I would have gone to, and some are not colors that she would have gone to. But the whole place, now that I'm living in all those colors the last 3 years, I've started being much more sensitive to different colors, not only of the objects that I buy, but the clothes that I wear, because it was risky. They were risky colors, and they worked. So now I have much more confidence about things visual.
Fred Hirsch is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up, speaking of Fred's loft, an interior designer aims for chaos. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 talking with the jazz pianist and composer Fred Hirsch. We're talking about harmony. Our next story is about a man who tries to build a kind of harmony around him and around his clients. George Balarian is a former furniture designer who now heads something called Material Connection. Material Connection is a resource center for designers and architects, and he's been working on how to achieve serenity in interior design. He agreed to show Jocelyn Gonzalez his method, and they started at his home.
I expect I'm going to see an impeccably designed space at George Balarian's New York apartment, a home where every chair or decoration has been carefully chosen for maximum impact, and the elements complement each other exactly, the kind of space you wish you could lift from a designer catalog. I was right about the impact part, but way off on the matching.
The sort of 9-foot dining oval table is a reinforced fiberglass, and it's white, so that's kind of a safe area. The big bowl on the center is a big slab of white Carrara marble, and yet the chairs, they're ribbed velvet, designed by Cini Boeri, on three legs with thick chrome polished legs. We didn't try to match anything, but somehow they all look smoothly blended into each other.
As I walk through George's home, I do notice that nothing matches. In fact, there seems as if there's no two of anything anywhere.
The art gallery corridor that you see has just enough paintings to keep your eyes busy. The Andy Warhols are obviously the repeat of the same in four different colors. The Japanese painting is just about as multicolored as you can be. Is it surrealist painting, as you notice? So the gallery is like a little trip that gets you excited and gets your blood going.
From the gallery, a two-story wall curves voluptuously into the lower living room space. As I follow it down the stairs, everything between my eyes and my knees is jammed with unrelated images and colors, like the papier-mâché sculpture and the retro Milanese stereo living around the corner from each other. But my eye knits them together, because George has painted all the walls white, and he's installed a fairly strict grid of terracotta tile on the floor. The walls and the floor are a rhythm and a frame that anchors the excited chaos of furniture and art.
So it's not about going out and doing the place by buying and putting them in the right places. The most important thing for me, really, if you want the truth, is the shell, the architectural shell of the house. If the shell is good, anything you put in it begins to look right. And, you know, you're surrounded with materials here, chrome, ceramic tile, wool, urethane, brass, chrome, you know, inlaid, fiberglass. And yet, do you sit and analyze each one? No, because they're harmonious together. And it's like one nice experience. It's the Balarian experience here.
George is pretty fearless and comfortable with so much contrast, while I'm nervous about anything that doesn't come in even-numbered sets. But I come to understand that it's the emotional or personal vibration you get from your things that counts when you're trying to get them to fit together.
You think those two chairs that are almost identical but they're not bother me? No. But you see, it works because it's just for a moment you notice a difference, and the difference could be nice. So this one will be my chair, the other one will be your chair, and that makes a story.
From George Balarian's home, we go to the sanctuary of St. Peter's Church. It's a beautiful tent-like structure hunched in the shadow of the steel and glass skyscrapers of the Citicorp Center on Lexington Avenue. This church is famous for its minimalist interior that was designed by Massimo Vignelli. It seems harmonious with its spiritual intentions.
The space has a splendid height accentuated by the organ and the pipes that shimmer in their metallic anodized or brushed chrome look. And the massive amount of materials here are the granite floors, gray and large modules, square slabs with very rectilinear benches that are in American red oak. The space is highlighted by a beautiful iron Celtic cross in the back The only color in this space are the benches that have these geometric cushions, and they are heavily into the pinks, oranges, purples, and green. Rather outlandish compared to the minimalist look of everything else. I figured out why this church should be this way, and it's because it's in the middle of the city, right in the heart of the hassle and bustle, as they say. So you need a space to take you away from that madness outside. And when you go into a Baroque church, there's a combination of magnificence, of gold leafing, incense, a lot of religious connotations and layers of culture, workmanships, and the whole thing blends itself into a tapestry of sensibilities, all combined to give you a big blanket of richness, which people need to comfort there and soothe them.
But here in the midday stillness of St. Peter's, the right angles and extreme sameness of the materials evoke an unsettled sensation.
It's also plain. I just don't think that the fixtures and the benches complement in tonality well enough. I think it's mono style, uniform. Something is missing. It's not as peaceful that some other combination could have been.
We head upstairs to the chapel. This smaller space at first seems all clean lines and austere woodworking, with pews set at 45-degree angles to the center aisle. Three of the four white walls are covered with the massive bas-relief-type sculpture of Louise Nevelson, which have also been painted white.
This is very typical of her work. This one is even bigger and has no frame. 7/8 of the wall is covered by these cutouts that are glued and collaged on top of each other in clusters and in semicircles, in circles, in dots, and layered over each other. It's a big mumble-jumble of shapes that are unified into one cohesive and soothing space. This is a harmonious space.
The chapel splits the difference between the riot of colors, shapes, and textures of George's home and the seeming monotony of the sanctuary downstairs. As he's pointed out to me before, the harmony of a space comes from how you feel when you're in it, and this room has presence and transparency at the same time.
You could really let go and relax and get into a trance if you want here. And so I don't have to think about the space. It will just be there, pleasant and soothing for me.
For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the pianist and composer Fred Hirsch, and we're talking about harmony. Yet again, the question we've been dancing around more than once today of whether or not harmony equals a kind of simplicity or not. And that Mr. Balerian obviously believes that it's all about complexity.
To me, as I mentioned earlier, it's as a jazz musician, essentially, as an improvising musician, basically what I'm doing is I'm creating what I create in real time, just like a tennis match evolves in real time or a chess match. So in a way, I can't really think about what's going to happen 32 bars away. I have to play things as they come to me.
Like doing a radio show.
Exactly. And, you know, With people who have great confidence, like this designer, there's harmony in the confluence of how things look with each other, and maybe he can imagine what it's going to look like and just plant it there, or maybe he improvises and he buys objects that he likes regardless, and then the fun is putting them next to each other and juxtaposing them and not having too much. And And in a way, that's kind of what I try to do over the years, you know, of performing and improvising. You learn to, you know, whittle away some of the fat. You have a certain amount of confidence as what might work and where you can push it and where you can't. But harmony is not necessarily, quote, harmonious.
That I think you've hit the crux. And it reminds me of an old friend of mine says that there are in the world can be divided into people who like Florence and the people who like Venice. Both of those cities are full of harmony, rich harmonies. But Florence is obviously more harmonious in a kind of monolithic, white, perfect way, whereas Venice is insane, and I think one goes one way or the other. Just as one, I mean, I think New Yorkers, if they like New York and if they choose to live here for 25 or 30 or 40 years, something about them wants to embrace the funky, disparate chaos of the place.
Well, it is that kind of tapestry thing. And I moved to New York 25 years ago, and it was a lot grittier and, frankly, a lot more fun, a lot less safe, but it was a lot more, it was more interesting in a kind of a way, you know, and it wasn't all, you know, mall stores and kind of Times Square sanitized. There was a little danger. There was a little.
Come over to Brooklyn. There's still plenty of funk in this.
Yeah, city. I know. I'm not saying, you know, but you're speaking about the CityCorps, the church at CityCorps Center. You know, that's also the place where most jazz musicians' funerals are held.
Why is that?
For many, many years, the pastor there was kind of the pastor to the jazz community, and Monk's memorial was held there, and I just played there for Joe Henderson's memorial last year, and that's. And when you step into that beautiful room from the craziness of Lexington Avenue, it is a wonderful oasis.
Well, it's what you said before about the lights against the darks and the highs against the lows, is that the whole thing, the whole tapestry and panorama can be harmonious, and you can have this place of kind of minimalist still. And then, you know, right outside you can have, you know, 8 bodegas and guys shouting and, you know, 100 typefaces in 50 yards.
Well, it's like cooking, you know. On paper, there are certain things or combinations that really you would think this would really be nauseating. But in the right hands, at the right time and the right way, it's really amazing. The same thing with musical harmony or visual, you know, art or interior design. They're all, you know, they're things that you wouldn't, that don't go by the rules, but somehow when they come together, they work and they create a resonance that's cumulative.
Well, speaking of the right time, our show is almost over. And speaking of the right hands, I would love you, Fred Hirsch, to return to the piano and play us out.
I think I'll play it tune of mine that I wrote in the late 80s at a time when I was playing with a lot of, a lot of straight-ahead jazz situations. I was working heavily with people like Joe Henderson and Art Farmer, and it seemed like I was playing a great deal of tunes that ended up being in C minor and E flat major and F major, which are all great keys for trumpets and saxophones and not necessarily the most resonant keys for the piano. Anyway, so I decided to write a tune where I wanted to use all of the most bright keys on the piano, which are D major, G major, A major, E major, and B major. And with the idea that it was happy peppy, bursting with love, but, you know, in the middle of a set, when you're playing tunes in these other kind of more neutral keys, that it would just sort of come across as a breath of some fresh air. And the title of the tune is Heart Song. Thank you.
Fred Hirsch's newest album, Songs and Lullabies, which is a collaboration with Norma Winstone, came out last month. You can find out more about him and anything else you've heard on the show today at studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Matthew Sherman,
Megan Metcalf,
Gardner Allen,
Michael Rayfield,
Andy Lancet.
And special thanks to Scott Strickland. The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by donors to PRI's Producers Forum, who include Dr. Claire Gaudiani and Christopher and Elizabeth Sullivan. Additional support provided by Nonesuch Records, featuring Buenos Hermanos, the new solo album by Buena Vista Social Club vocalist Ibrahim Ferrer, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360,
I walk along the street of sorrow.
Tony Bennett.
Well, I was very fascinated with Art Tatum and the way he made a production out of a popular song. And Stan Getz had this wonderful honey sound that took those two artists and started thinking that way.
Tony Bennett on artistic influence next time in Studio 360 from PRI. You behold your shattered scheme.